G'day, Groovers. Welcome to another installment of the U Project. For the 349th time, I am here doing this. You were there having a listen. Well, maybe not 349th time, although some of you are a little bit crazy and have listened to all of them multiple times. Some of you are new to the U Project train. Toot, toot. Welcome aboard. We hope you're enjoying life and surviving all things bloody summer and Christmas and New Year and COVID and all of that. Hi, Tiff.
Hi, Craig.
Are you all right?
I'm very good, thanks.
It's pretty warm. I don't know what the temp is where you are, but it's, as I sit here in the thriving metropolis of Hampton at 11:07, it's heading towards 34. Big, bold, beautiful, glorious degrees in our fine city by the bay. What about you?
I peeled myself out of bed, even though I didn't get to sleep till a stupid hour last night. I peeled myself out to do a 6:30 boxing class because I didn't want to be training any later because it was only going to get hotter.
So are you still an OCD, obsessive compulsive workaholic? Is that still going on or?
Correct.
How's just that working?
So on Sunday nights, I have a bit of a struggle winding down and getting to sleep because I just cruise on doing some work into the night, and then I'm on the computer too late, and then I'm looking at blue light, and then I'm in bed, and then my brain's fired up and I'm thinking about all my plans, and then it's 3 a.m.
Mm. So you'd be pretty single then?
Very single. I don't know what's gone wrong.
Yeah, me either. But don't ask me. I'm twice your age and twice as single. So our guest today, thanks to you, who you've had on your podcast, is Dr. Stephen Parnas, who is a consultant emergency physician at, I could have this wrong, but this is what I gleaned off the internet. He'll tell me in a moment, St. Vincent's. Royal Victorian Eye and Ear Hospital and Werribee Mercy Hospital as well. Did I get any of that right, Doc?
You got all of it right, Craig.
Oh, good. Perfect. Yeah. Where do we find you? Where are you today? Well, I kind of know what you're doing because you told us before we came live, but you're in Victoria. And yes, what's going on? What's going on today?
Well, I'm in isolation at home, actually, because on Friday last week, we got some news across Australia that a case got out in Brisbane of a quarantine worker who'd contracted one of the new variants of COVID and taken it into the community. And it was unclear whether that had spread at all. As a consequence, anyone who had been in Brisbane up to and including the 2nd of January needed to isolate. Certainly that was the advice of the Victorian authorities, and that captured me because I'd been on holiday in Queensland until the 2nd of January. And so for the last few days, I've come home. I had a swab, which thankfully tested negative. And maybe there were other things that I could have done behind the desk or around the house, but I've basically had my feet up watching the cricket and thinking about the year ahead.
Well, good for you, son. I'm guessing you don't have too many weeks of nothingness on planet U.
Yeah, you're right. I've got three hospitals. I'm on a company board. I've got three kids, and life's pretty busy. And I think there is a lot to be said for having time to reflect, time to recharge the batteries. And even though I did have two lovely weeks off over Christmas, New Year, after what we went through last year, I think that's never going to be enough. So you take it when you can get it.
I feel like we get a level of perspective and awareness and sometimes insight when we're away from the momentum of our normal life, when we're away from the busyness and the commitments and kind of the groundhog dayness of what we do. And then when you, I don't know if it's just me, but I find when I'm interstate, if I'm traveling for a gig and I'm in a hotel and I'm, you know, I'm literally going to Perth for 2 hours of work, but I'm away for 2 days, I have a level of clarity that I don't have when I'm in the middle of my stuff. And also I took 2 weeks off over Christmas where I did zero study and almost zero work. And I just find you can tap into stuff that you can't when you're busy all the time.
I think that's essential. And I've always understood, I think, the need for stillness and space and quiet. But as life and my career has progressed, I have found it getting busier and busier. And that's fine. It's good and enjoyable to be productive and to make a substantial difference at a lot of levels. But, you know, I'm in my early 50s now, and I've been thinking very carefully about where life is going to head for me. And one of the things about someone like me and about a lot of doctors is that we spend so much time thinking about our professional responsibilities and goals and achievements. And I think sometimes it is really important to take the foot off the accelerator a little bit and to think about the quality of one's efforts rather than the amount of it, and to be a bit gentler on oneself. That's one of my key lessons from 2020, I think.
I'm going to ask you a philosophical question straight up. So how much of your identity do you get from what you do? Your sense of self? Like where does Stephen Parnas end? Or where does the title and the responsibilities and the role and the skills and the academic prowess and all that, which is all amazing, by the way? I struggled with plasticine in grade 3, so you're a fucking hero to me. But where does that stuff end, and where does just Stephen Parnas, the bloke, start?
That's been an ongoing challenge for me. I suspect I still probably invest too much into that notion of professional achievement. Maybe that idea that unless I demonstrate what I can do for others, I will not be valued or loved or respected by people. You know, that may be a feeling that makes its way back to early childhood. I'm the son of migrants, the first in my extended family of 70 or 80 to go to university. You know, that real sense of responsibility. But there is a time when it is important to recognise that those things are still relatively superficial, and that we are of intrinsic value because of who we are, not of what we do. And I think that's important at a few levels. One, because perfectionism is never satisfied.
Mm.
And it's just not possible. And I think I can do better and gain more satisfaction and achieve more if I am more accepting of my shortcomings, my human frailties in what I do. To use one example, to enable myself to, whenever I can in the chaos of an emergency department, just stop for 10 minutes and listen to a patient's story, not feel guilty about spending a couple of minutes enjoying a bit of a chat, if that's possible, as well as that idea of, you know, all of the things that I have to do when I'm running a department. These are the things that I'm becoming more interested in as my career goes on.
Yeah, that's really interesting. A couple of things stick out for me there. It's like, you know, for me, who's been a patient a fair few times, as have most people, but when somebody like you comes by, who I would go, this is the guy, and, you know, where as a patient, there's fear and there's anxiety and there's doubt and there's unknown. And then you come in, the voice of calm and reason with all these skills and all this knowledge and all this ability, and you stand by or sit by my bed for 5 or 10 minutes and invest in me, I'm going to remember that for 10 years. Right? That's a really big deal to me as a patient. And for you, it's just one of many things that you do. It's not that it's unimportant. It's just that it's one of many things that you do in a day. And I think to have that, and of course you can't do that for everyone all the time because it's practically impossible, but that ability to have that presence of mind and that awareness to go, listen, you know, I have to say that to myself sometimes. You're not that important, Craig. Just shut up and be present and listen to this person. And even though you've had a conversation like this a million times because of what you do and who you are, same with me and my job in terms of I do a lot of listening. But some people have, you know, that's the only memory that they will have of that experience or that workshop they come to where there's hundreds of people and they want to ask me a question at the end and I've already answered 100 questions and I'm starving. And you go, all I want is a fucking chicken roll with some mayo. And you go, pull your head in, just be present. So,
yes.
And I think that, you know, being technically brilliant and, you know, being able to do all the things you need to do medically and make great decisions and be present and be the calm in the chaos and all of that, but, you know, not without compassion, not without empathy, not without awareness, you know, it really matters a lot.
I agree. I think at this stage in my life, I think about my experience and there's a few that are confronting. Today in Victoria is the day when interns, first-year doctors, start their jobs officially. They've had a couple of orientation days and or maybe even an orientation week. We had a couple of hours when I did it. But that's a confronting thing for them. I still feel a bit of anxiety when I go to work sometimes, and that's 28 years on. Wow. Now, I remember what it was like to be an intern and, you know, that idea of literally having to suppress anxiety or panic, that's not an uncommon feeling for people, even though they've spent many years getting to that point in their training. The other thing is, as you said, that experience of being a patient, and it happens to us all sooner or later. I routinely say to people, when you're a patient, you've really only got one major decision, and that is, do you have trust and confidence in the people looking after you? Because if you do, then you let them do their job. Now, this isn't a blank check. Informed consent and ongoing discussion about things is essential in any aspect of medical care. But I know from my own circumstances that that's what it boiled down to when I've seen people from either my GP to an orthopaedic surgeon and noting extreme vulnerability and being grateful for, as you say, that care, respect and time that they have given me to listen, to try and understand and then to put the best of their expertise into making recommendations to you. And they're all humbling experiences, and I remember that. Only last week I treated two people in one of my emergency departments who had been former teachers of mine. They were senior doctors when I was an intern, so they were in their 50s when I was just starting.
Wow.
You know, the differences in the medical hierarchy were huge. And now, you know, they're in their 80s, frail, and I'm the boss. Two things. It reminded me that it is a privilege to look after them and that none of us remain all powerful. And also that today's medical students and interns are probably going to be looking after me if I make it to my 80s.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. We've spoken a lot on this podcast with people who've been through all kinds of adversity and tragedy and, you know, people who've lost limbs in horrendous accidents and, you know, all that kind of stuff and ambos and paramedics and a broad cross section of humanity. But one of the common themes that comes up for some reason is dealing with trauma and, you know, self-management from an emotional and a psychological point of view around that, around anxiety, you know, fear and all the many kind of implications of not sleeping, you know, emotional kind of issues, mental health issues, relationship issues, social issues. You are often in the middle of what to most people would be a really traumatic moment or situation. How do you manage the trauma? How do you manage the mayhem where obviously, apart from being able to do what you need to do medically and make great decisions and do great things and instruct and lead and teach and coach and mentor and run the show and be the boss, you're still a bloke and you still got emotions and feelings and thoughts and you still got to go to bed and sleep. Do you have, it's a very long question, Tiff. You should have cut me off halfway. I apologize, everyone. Everyone's like, get the fuck on with it. But what I want to know is how you self-manage in the middle of the trauma. How do you relax? How do you be the calm in the chaos?
You could probably summarize it by a line that I got from a book that a lot of doctors have read over the decades. It's called The House of God, which is a very cynical view of an American hospital about 30 or 40 years ago. By a psychiatrist named Samuel Shem. And it's there are rules from the House of God. And one of the rules was, at a cardiac arrest, you take your own pulse.
Wow.
Which sounds ironic because, you know, it's all about the patient. But when there are stressful circumstances, I know that I've got to monitor my own response to these things.
Yeah.
I've got to know which buttons are being pushed. I've got to know when I'm starting to get irritable. What are the things that make me lose my poise or balance? Some of that might be fatigue. Some of that might be continual interruption. Some of that will often be being confronted with complex or difficult situations medically or logistically where I find that I'm out of my comfort zone. Either lots of staff have called in sick, or I'm dealing with a medical topic that I've never been particularly comfortable with. So I know those things. They might set me off. I think that I've learned that the consequences of me getting irritated is that I could start being a bit surly with the people around me. I could be a bit short-tempered or angry or the like. I've become better at monitoring that and suppressing that. I find even simple things like talking about it with a trusted colleague, even if it's a couple of, 30 seconds in a corridor. I think positive self-talk is extremely important to me. Things like saying, well, you know, you've been through these things before, the clock will continue to pass, you'll get through it, you know who to call for help. And I also remind myself that what I do is never solo, that there is always a team around me, whether it's physically there, and that's usually the case in emergency, or on the end of a phone, or someone to debrief afterwards, or I also break down decisions into the next time period. And that may be the next 10 minutes. What do I have to get through in the next 10 minutes? These are the sorts of things that I use, and I often make a point now of whenever I possibly can, going and making myself a cup of tea and just having that physical break from the department. And my next reaction is, well, how are they going to cope without you, Steve? You're the boss on the floor. Well, so much of a department is free of emergency consultants overnight, and if they can do it for 8 hours without me, then they can do it for 15 minutes without me at this point. So in summary, these are the sorts of things that I say to myself, that I recognise and that I do to cope. And then there's all the other stuff that I dare say you will have a lot of expertise on. Where possible, I do try and eat well. I try and not overdo it with alcohol. I try and get enough sleep. I'm a night owl, so that's a problem. And the other one that I'm trying to work on, this very morning I was having a chat before we started with the podcast with my fiance, who's a Brisbane-based emergency physician, and she said, Steve, you really need to work on a hobby or two, because I don't really have hobbies or don't indulge in them enough. And those are the things that build the joy and reward of life that make it easier to cope with those more difficult aspects of professional and personal life.
Yeah. Yeah, I think having a focus other than your job or your career, having something else that's, you know, just whether or not it's just for fun or whether or not it's a project or whether or not it's doing some kind of, you know, some online learning or whatever it is, just having something which takes your attention and your mind away from the thing that you do most of the time. Yes. I think that in itself is healthy. It occurred to me while you were kind of describing what you do, that part of your job would be, I'm guessing, correct me if I'm wrong, but part of your job would be giving people bad news on a regular basis. What a terrible job. I'd never really thought about that till just then. I thought, fuckity fuck, imagine having to on a daily or maybe hourly, I don't know, but do you have a process? Of course you have a process, but is it something that's just evolved? Is it the same kind of approach each time? How do you navigate that yourself?
Yeah, it's a tough job, but it's rewarding being with people at some of those most intimate and powerful moments of their life. That is, I think, the greatest privilege of being a doctor.
Wow.
That you are walking with people when they are at their with all the layers removed, whether they are high-powered businessmen, leaders of government, or a homeless person. You are with them, you are witnessing their humanity, and I've had that privilege, although it happens incredibly rarely these days, of delivering babies. Now it's only emergency settings where that happens and it's pretty quick. But also I have been with many people as they've died and or giving them the difficult diagnosis. So my starting point is it's a privilege. I try as much as humanly possible to remove all distractions. So setting matters, you know, the relative's room, the quiet place, give the admitting officer phone to someone else. You often will have a colleague in there as well. Middle-aged man can be fairly intimidating. Having a female colleague, medical or nursing, is often a good counterbalance as well. You have the right people in there. You try and not shock or surprise. You build up to these things, not as a delaying tactic, but to help prepare people. You don't lie, but you are careful with your language. Everything is framed in the context of respect and truth. You recognise that the responses are going to be everything from denial to anger, that the ability of a person or a family member to be able to process things may stop after you mention a word like, we're not able to fix this, or and I rarely use the word fix. You have a growth, and if that is this cancer, we think it is. You don't extrapolate, you don't guess. You tell them what you know, and you tell them what you don't know, which is often the case when, for example, you see a politician or a public health officer talking about the measures that a society has to take to respond to a pandemic, because you recognise that the responses are not necessarily going to be those of a computer, but a human being with all of the emotion. And you know you'll have to repeat things. You know that there needs to be time for silence, time for people to be comfortable with that. And you know, the other one is that there are times when those other human interactions like touch matter. That idea of putting one's hand on someone's a patient's hand, or giving a hug to someone. Now, you know, in a world like ours where there have been misinterpretations or abuse of power or abuse, these sorts of things. They are always risky. But some of this is intuition that I have developed over years. But generally speaking, I've got it right. And that has been a rewarding thing. So I've taken a long time in saying it, but it is something that I never shy away from. And I think it's one of my strengths as a doctor that I do that, I hope, reasonably well, and that I can teach my junior colleagues that these are the sorts of things that if we do them well, then we have done a good job that day.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I love that. I love everything you said then, because the truth is that, you know, I have hard conversations, but not that hard, but I have hard conversations with people about their lifestyle or their food or the state of their body or, you know, their habits and behaviors. And sometimes they're confronting and, you know, but sometimes people are literally slowly killing themselves. In fact, quickly killing themselves in some cases with their lifestyle and behavior and choices. But even when you are perhaps clinically accurate or you're presenting the information, you're still dealing with a human being. You're still dealing with an emotional, social, you know, psychological, spiritual, perhaps, depending on your belief system, creature or being. And, you know, just wheeling out facts and data is not a great process. And so I think that they're, well, it's not the most, it's probably not the most effective process when you're dealing with human beings. But as you said there, like there needs to be a level of, I believe, intuition and awareness that you go, look, I feel like giving this person a hug. And, you know, but you're right in that it's tough that we live in this culture, in this collective mindset now that even in a clinical setting or a medical setting, when you just want to comfort somebody, as is the case with you, or is the case with me, sometimes if someone's crying and somebody's upset, even I still hesitate to hug them. I'm much more comfortable hugging a guy because I know there's probably going to be no potential ramifications. But I always hesitate too a little bit with a female because I think, gee, can this be misinterpreted and can somebody, and so that's, you know, that's something we just have to navigate in 2021, I guess. But I like to hear you say that you're a bit instinctive, you're a bit intuitive, and it's not all just rote and it's not all just prescriptive behavior. And it's not the same kind of model fits all in terms of the human stuff.
No, this is the whole concept of professionalism, which is incredibly important in medicine. We have a series of rights and authority that no one else in the community has. In other contexts, what we do would be considered assault. Now, you have to use that power appropriately, and that's where ethics are essential, where understanding the legal circumstances and constraints are important, and also practical reality. For example, the pandemic has changed an enormous number of things. The fact that I am often covered by a face mask and a shield and gloves and a gown, depending on circumstances. But things like having a chaperone, having that other person there, having the passing over the box of tissues, these are all signs of respect. And, you know, that sense of knowing that privilege is important. You know, I was with some people who died alone last year when the Melbourne second wave hit, and family were not physically able to be there in either because it was too fast sometimes, or they were separated by distance, or, you know, we were surrounded by COVID patients. So, yes, intuition, decision-making, how you communicate, these are the things that, how you bring those together is hopefully what I can do at this stage in my career and you and yours.
You know, we've spoken on the show a lot with people who have been kind of outsiders looking in. And of course, everybody's got an opinion, as do I. Nobody needs to know. It's not that interesting. And a lot of people who have been kind of support staff and nurses. And we spoke with, have you ever heard of a guy called Dinesh Palepana?
No.
Yeah, he just won Queenslander.
Australian. I'm sorry, I have. Yes, I knew about him through AMA Queensland. Dinesh had, I think, a cervical spine injury and became quadriplegic.
Yeah.
I remember when he graduated, I think he was interested in radiology, and now he's doing emergency medicine.
Yeah, yeah, and he's just a fucking superstar human, and he's a lawyer and he's a doctor and he's doing legal stuff and also working full-time medical, and he's a quadriplegic. And but, you know, we had a conversation with him. He was amazing. And just that, you know, some people you meet, like such a beautiful human being and such great energy. Like, I literally, I want to be his friend, you know, and he sends, like, every now and then he'll send me a message that I go, like, there's no, you know how when some people, I'm digressing a bit, sorry, Doc, but you know,
the drill.
Some people send you messages, Tiff, Doc, and you know, yeah, this is a little bit strategic. You know what I mean? It's nice, but it's a bit strategic. It's a bit like, I know why they're doing this. Not everyone, lots of people don't do that. But he just sends these messages that I go, there's no agenda with this guy. And he sent me a message a couple of weeks ago and said, "Hi, mate, sorry to bother you." He said, "But there's this nurse who works here. She's ace and she's been working really hard and she follows your podcast and she thinks you're ace, and could you send her a message?" I'm thinking, how nice of that. I said, "Sure." I said, "Get me her details. I'll send her a book." So I spoke with her and, you know, we had a chat, and then I just thought it's so nice that somebody actually, in especially with the limitations and restrictions and challenges he has, is that aware and cares that much. Anyway, I was going to, so that's Dinesh. We love Dinesh. If you're listening, mate, shout out to you. Think you're ace. What I was going to say was, but somebody who's been in the middle of it all and with COVID patients who have passed away, how's it affected you? How do you think different? Has it affected you, not just as a doctor, but as a bloke?
It has affected me profoundly in lots of ways over the last 10 to 12 months. I think the first thing is that idea that I give myself a bit more permission to be gentler with myself. If I need a day or two to just do nothing and not tick anything off the to-do list, then I'll try and be a bit gentler about that. The other is it just reinforced that idea that adversity is the greatest teacher. We won't need to go into the adversity of working in hospitals, particularly in Victoria. I've learnt a lot in the last few months. I've grown closer to my colleagues, hopefully more understanding and supportive of them and they of me. Personally, a lot more respectful and admiring of my kids. They are 20, 18 and 12, and what they have done in getting through education, isolation, in the midst of these difficulties has amazed me. And my son got through year 12 last year and did brilliantly. And the world's at his feet. And he's a gentle, empathetic soul. So, you know, just incredibly proud of all three of them. Closer to my neighbours. This isn't the first time I've been in isolation. And when I did early in last year, I had a number of them texting me and knocking on the door saying, who's going to do the shopping or cut the grass or those sorts of things for you. So really supportive. The other was the distance from my fiance. She lives in Brisbane, and we spent 5 months apart because of the isolation. We're getting married in April this year. Now, we got engaged at the beginning of 2020. We didn't expect that the engagement would be what it turned out to be, but we have continued to grow closer and do as much as we could in terms of time together online. And I think our relationship has thrived through that adversity. So I'm very much looking forward to April. The uncertainty of the pandemic means that, you know, you can't count on the day going ahead, but we will, pardon me, Tiffany, we will roll with the punches on this.
Boom.
So, you know, I've learnt a lot. I hope I've become a bit wiser and, I'm looking forward to a time when we can be a little bit more relaxed about, you know, isolation and masks and the like.
Well, mate, if you need a flower girl, Tiff loves a good wedding. And if your MC pulls out, just let me know, son, I'll be there.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about, I feel like we had, I can't remember his surname, I feel really bad. We had a guy on last year who I love, Alex, the neurosurgeon from Queensland. What's his name? It'll come to me. Anyway, we love Alex, and he was Australia's, I think he was Australia's youngest ever neurosurgeon. But anyway, we had a great conversation, but we spoke about how you almost need to be, in almost an unhealthy way, obsessive to get, you know, to get to that level of excellence and to do what you do, to be so effective and to wear so many hats and to, you know, work in three hospitals and to be the leader and to make great decisions. And you've got to be disciplined and you've got to be focused, but you've almost got to be obsessive, you know. Would you call yourself obsessive? Would you call yourself disciplined? How would you describe the way your relationship with your work and your study and the, you know, your drive for excellence?
I think those things have changed over time. The person I was at the age of 20 or 30 or 35, and I was only fully qualified as an emergency specialist at the age of 37, I think. I think all of those things have evolved over time. There are times when I am absolutely obsessive, and that's necessary when you are, for example, intubating a person in a resus bay. That idea that this is the process you follow, these are your backup steps, you've got your systems in place, your training, all you shut out all of the distractions. And so if you're doing a medical procedure, and this is where, for example, a neurosurgeon would do that much more frequently, then you must be obsessive. I don't like doing things by halves. And, you know, I got this drummed into me by my father when I was a kid. My personality lends itself to it. And that idea is, if you're going to do something, do it properly. Now, that's good. But everything has a flip side too. I might be a bit hesitant to do something because of fear of failure, to not have a go because I'm afraid of making a mistake. So I think you'll find that in every case with personality, your strength is simultaneously your weakness. I like to think empathetic, but I'm also relatively thin-skinned. All of these things are evolving over time. I draw energy from being with people. I'm well and truly an extrovert, but I also learn to appreciate that value of some solitude. So these are the aspects of I hope, my personality. And, you know, the other one that I think we can always continue to improve on is our listening skills. Because when I have a conversation, yes, there is so much in what another person says that triggers my own experience, but I'm trying to learn to hold the tongue, let those things pass and occasionally reflect on those with them. But it's better to listen because I'll get more out of it if I do.
He's very self-aware, isn't he, Tiff? Don't you think? He goes all right, doesn't he? And for a bloke who's a little bit of a rock star, he's pretty humble. I like that. All right, we're nearly done. You've done very well. I'm going to give you a HD. Well done. Thank you. you fucking perfectionist. In an alternate reality, if you didn't become a doctor or anything in the medical space, what might you have become or what might you have done?
The other one that always comes to mind is political leadership. I've been interested in public affairs since I was a kid. When I was a little boy, Mum and Dad had some American encyclopedias. I remembered memorising the list of American presidents because that was an American set of encyclopedias. A teacher at school said, "What about Australian prime ministers?" And I didn't know anything about them because we didn't have anything Australian there. So I learnt about that. And I think had things gone in a slightly different direction, that's probably where I would have ended up, because it's about dealing with people. It's about dealing with important matters. It's about making complex decisions. And it's about not doing things by halves. So that's probably the alternate reality, I think, right?
Now, I don't want to open a Pandora's box because we could go anywhere, but okay, let's talk about the pandemic, and just give me 1 or 2 minutes on how you think we've handled it as a nation. So how the government, politicians, what's your kind of report card?
Yeah. There's been a lot of argy-bargy. There's been a lot of state, federal, conservative, progressive friction, but by world standards, Australia has done incredibly well. It hasn't been perfect, but no response has been perfect. I think where we are at the moment compared to places where I have colleagues wilting under terrible, nightmare, hellish circumstances is that we are living incredibly well in Victoria and the rest of the country as well. We've got a good healthcare system. We've got political leaders who, by and large, have been accepting of the expert advice. And we have a community who are prepared to put community need ahead of individual rights. So I'm grateful and proud that we are where we are. We're not out of the woods yet. The vaccine will not be an overnight get out of jail card, but it will certainly get us to a much more normal life. And I think as a community and as individuals, we will all emerge from this changed. That's my summary, Craig.
I like it. I love it. All right, last question. If everything goes shit hot on planet Stephen for the next 5 years, everything goes awesome, what's happening on planet you in 5 years, if everything works out as you hope, and what's the update?
Well, I think happily married, healthy, fulfilled young adult children, enjoyment in my work, and probably less hours at the coalface for me, and a much more confident answer to the question, what are your hobbies, Stu? They're my objectives.
Well, definitely don't get my hobbies, because one of them's motorbikes and I've got many. So just definitely don't take that up in your 50s. Dr. Stephen Parnas, mate, we really appreciate you. You're genuinely fascinating, and that was a great conversation. And thank you for being part of the U Project.
Thanks very much, Craig. And thanks, Tiffany.
Thanks, Stephen.
Stay there, chap. Tiff is quite good. Thank you for that.
I loved that. I really loved that.
Yeah, he was good. You told me he wasn't that good, but turns out he's really
Turns out he's actually really bloody brilliant. I always deliver the goods.
See everyone. Love you guts.